Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Caged In, the podcast where week by week we go film by film through the career of Nicolas Cage to find out if he is the world's greatest detective, figuring out just exactly what crimes are in a script and figures out a way to make them right and give us the greatest films we've ever seen, or if he's a low down dirty crook committing crimes against cinema. And this week under the microscope, it is Ken Sanzel's 2019 noir-inspired crime drama, Kill Chain. And to join me to figure out if this film is up there with the pantheon of Cage classics or needs to be thrown in the bin, like many a Cage direct-to-video release, is Devon Taylor from the fantastic Bloody Blunt's Cinema Club, but we'll get into that in a moment in the main bulk of the episode. As always, I asked Devon, is he a Nick Cage fan? What was his first and which is his favourite Nicolas Cage film? If you would like a little bit extra from myself and Devon, head on over to Patreon where you can get me asking Devon three extra bonus questions, which are, which is his least favourite Nicolas Cage film, which is his favourite all-time Nicolas Cage performance, and which living or dead director would he love to see Nicolas Cage work with? So you can do that as easy as heading over to patreon.com/cagedinpod. When it comes to Kill Chain and this episode, like every episode, we go into massive spoilers. We spoil it fucking rotten. So if you'd like to watch this film, and this is one personally I would recommend you watch, there's a handy document in the show notes that will tell you if and where this film is streaming. And at current moment of recording, the 13th of January 2021, this film is streaming both in the UK and the US on Amazon Prime, so you have no excuse as to not watch it. So if you're back with us, you've either watched the film, you are ready and raring to either agree or disagree with myself and Devon. So there's one thing left to do, guys, and that's to get raging with Cage. This episode, we look at a man who's decided he just wants to settle down and retire, become a hotelier. Nicolas Cage is done with the rat race and now wants to run the Quaint Franco's, Colombia's hottest boutique hotel. But it's not all plain sailing. Just like last week's film, Kill Chain is a post-Tarantino crime drama hell-bent on chatting about the action rather than showing us any. To talk about Ken Sanzel's movie is photographer, filmmaker, Nightmare on Film Street writer, and host of the great Bloody Blunt Cinema Club podcast, Devon Taylor. How are you, Devon?
I'm doing fantastic. Thank you for having me on. That was a fantastic intro. I applaud you on that. And yeah, I'm a podcaster, a writer. I do a little bit of everything. I do some video production, the music world as well. And horror is my main jam. That's what we cover on the Blade Blunt Cinema Club. It's focused on subgenres of horror and kind of digging deeper into that. So I'm very excited to, you know, kind of get a break from talking horror movies. And this is still a genre, obviously, but another film subject I'm very passionate about, Mr. Nicolas Cage.
Perfect. Well, that you've come to the right place to talk all things Nicolas Cage. And on your podcast, you touched on the, I think, massively underrated and overlooked a lot of the time, Vampire's Kiss. And you teamed it up with, like, American Psycho, which is the perfect pairing. And I think, and to quote previous guest Brad Hansen, it took for Peter Lowe to crawl for Patrick Bateman to walk. And that, like, that's how I feel about that film. And I'd like to thank you for covering those films together like they should be.
It really did. Like, American Psycho is, like, my favorite movie ever. Like, tied with The Neon Demon, actually. But American Psycho, I've loved it forever. I was late to the Vampire's Kiss game because I kind of shrugged it off as, like, the way that people, you know, put it out there, that it was like, you know, like it was like the silly B movie kind of stuff. And I was just like, yeah, you know, I'll get to it eventually. I think there's more other interesting Nick Cage endeavors to get to. But then I said, you know what, I'm going to throw it on. So I watched it earlier this year. And I was just like, oh my God, no, this is actually really good. And then I was like, and it is also the same movie as American Psycho. Like, they are basically the same.
It's just much, like, maligned, and like, it's meme fodder now. I think that's the disservice the internet has done to that film, is it's like, it's reactionary gifs, or it's that sizzle reel of Nicolas Cage losing his shit that people go like, I'm just going to palm that one off as like one I'm not going to give any attention to. But I know, like, from a GQ interview, he notes it as like one of his like favorite performances he's ever done. And you can kind of see why. It's out there. It's wild.
Yeah. It's the movie. Whenever I read some interviews, I think it was, the GQ, like him breaking it down, and he like says, it's like, that's when he like kind of pioneered his classic operatic acting style that he adopts and like has made, obviously, you know, his own thing over his own career. But that's like the movie where it started, and like where he really honed in on it, and somebody had a movie and a script that was a story that was perfect for it. And I think, you know, we'll get a little bit more into that a little bit later, but you know, when you utilize Nick Cage perfectly, like, you know, you're going to get something special. And like Vampire's Kiss was like the first instance of that.
I think it was that kind of 1-2 punch of that and Raising Arizona that kind of showed us like this like manic craziness, like that. I don't know, you could always kind of see a glint in his eye in his earlier stuff, but it was those two he kind of really got to cut loose and cage out, for want of a better words. So it this probably feels like a futile question. You're a Nick Cage fan, right?
Yes. I mean, I am. I'm immensely a Nick Cage fan. I literally had to defend him like a few nights ago from my best friend's girlfriend who despises him. And I was just like, for an hour, I was just like, you just don't get it, okay? And I love him so much.
So at the time of recording, it's quite interesting because it's, what, December 12th? No, December 9th? Whatever. It's the day that it's just been announced that Nick Cage is hosting a Netflix series.
Yes.
All about the etymology of swear words. And it's like, we're really on, like, I think the cusp of a new era of Cage, this kind of self-aware, almost like he's taken a leaf from the Jeff Goldblum like handbook of just being like ultra super aware, doing these like playing to the kind of strengths and the, I don't know, supposed weaknesses that people see upon him, and really going for it.
Oh yeah, like that trailer just made my day. It is absolutely perfect. I can't wait for that show. And yeah, like, I mean, I would honestly say like that era did like kind of start like a couple years ago, you know, whenever mm-hmm. we start seeing him pop up in these art house films. And then like, and then, you know, like I said, like when you have these directors that are playing to his strengths, like Mandy and Mom and Dad. And, you know, he like, he started putting a little string together. And yeah, so then now he has that, the whole self-aware movie coming out. What is it? The unbearable weight of being famous or something like that. What is it?
Massive talent. It's even, massive it's talent. Even more arrogant. Yeah. It's like, that's what makes it so good.
So yeah, like we're in the thick of a Nikonissance, if you will. And I'm here for it. I've always been here for Nick Cage. Even when he wasn't in the spotlight, he was still doing stuff and I was still watching, you know, so like, but I'm excited that everyone else is like, you know, now that they know that he's in on the joke, now it's like, okay, now we're all in it together.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
so it's perfect.
Yeah. It's that thing. I keep wanting to look for a better way analogy for this, but like Nick Cage, even across this last 10 years, when it like, especially when he was the straight to DVD and VOD fodder, a lot of his career has become, he's almost like that, like partner who, like, is slightly abusive because he's putting you through all this shit. But then occasionally he'll bring you like some flowers. He'll bring you like a mum and dad, and you'll be like, oh, you know what? It kind of makes up for being shitty all that time.
Yeah, like that's what makes like the Nick Cage movie box like fun, because you don't know what you're gonna get. You're either you're gonna get a shitty movie that he slightly elevates with his presence, or you're going to get B, a legitimately good movie, you know, that he mm-hmm. happens to be in. And I would say that today's movie would fall into that category. I don't know where you fell with it. But so, you know, you don't know what you're going to get. So it's like I watched Kill Chain last night with a buddy. And it was just like, I told him, I was like, I haven't seen the trailer. I didn't look anything up. Like, because, like, I like to go in as blind as possible. I was like, and it's mm-hmm. Nick Cage, so who knows what we're going to get with this movie tonight. And we were pleasantly surprised.
Perfect. So, yeah, obviously, we've established that you're a Nick Cage fan. But what was the first Nick Cage movie you remember seeing?
It's really tough because, I mean, I can remember, like, watching scenes, not, like, all of Face Off and Con Air when I was super young. Like, I always remembered the prison scene in Face Off, but I just couldn't remember what the whole movie was. So it's like, I don't consider myself like watching it like, you know, an actual mm-hmm. watch up until, you know, maybe 5 years ago. And then, but then like Con Air was like one that I would like, it would pop up on TNT all the time, you know, so it's like I would catch some of it, but maybe not all of it. So I think the, like, you know, I really was like kind of paying attention to actors in movies was Ghost Rider. Like I'm on the young side. So, you know, Ghost Rider, I was only 10 or 11 when that came mm-hmm. out. And then I was like, who is, like, I was like, I've seen him like in things, but I was like, whoa, he's like, he's going fucking crazy. What's going on? And then like, I went to the VHS set. My parents had this giant VHS collection with like a bunch of shelves. And I remember going through the VHSs and I would look for his name. And then I think that's whenever I found Con Air and then was able to watch it start to finish. And then I would just try to find more Nick Cage movies. But then as I got older and started appreciating, you know, film a lot more and like kind of paying attention to acting and stuff. And just watching him, like, the people don't get, like, he loves acting. It's not like he mm-hmm. just, like, does craziness just for the hell of it. Like, everything he does is with a purpose. And, like, that, like, fascinates me as, like, you know, like, as an actor that I would like to, like, those type of actors that I want to work with whenever I make films, like, that mm-hmm. are very intentional in what they're doing in this, like, kind of, this focused chaos, you know. And like Nick Cage, he doesn't bring it to, like, you know, and like I said, I don't always think it's like his fault. It's just, I think certain directors utilize his you know, abilities better than others.
Yeah, well, there's that interesting thing because we're of a generation now of filmmakers like a Panos Cosmatos, and I think like a few others, even a Brian Taylor with Mom and Dad. That mm-hmm. you imagine they were Nick Cage fans growing up, so they get to work with him. And I think other directors are some of the directors of the lesser successful ones and the ones that don't quite work. Are fans, and I think like sometimes that might be a thing of like on set where they're like, oh shit, I don't know what to do with this. Like it's almost like they're fanboying out too much, and they're like, well, I've got Nick Cage in my movie, and I'm not really directing him, so like,
yeah,
now the film is just kind of like gone a bit awry and gone a bit loose, and it's
yeah,
I don't know. Whereas
I could totally see that being the case sometimes, like, you know, just like the, you know, the being starstruck of his presence. But that's like also a thing that I really like about Nick Cage is like I notice that he does a lot of movies with like, you know, filmmakers that don't have much credits. He will mm-hmm. be in a directorial debut for like an unknown director, which I think is really cool. Like he will sign on to something that he, you know, obviously believes in. And he believes in that filmmaker. And I think that's like really cool. And then, you know, it will come with mixed results, of course. But, you know, as an aspiring filmmaker myself, like that just is, you know, inspires me to be like, you know, I'm sure there, you know, might be an actor that, you know, I can, that might be willing to take a chance on me in my first movie, you know, something like that. You know, maybe not yep. Nick Cage, but I mean, that'd be cool.
Well, I think an actor who is like really cool for just like, being in anything and doesn't really say no is Danny Trejo. Like he's famously known for like you got a student movie and you want Machete, like he will turn up and be like, yeah, come on, yeah, let's do it, like yeah, $500 for the film, like I'm in it. And it's like it like Cage has that kind of, I'm not sure what his fee is, but like yeah, like you said, he's got this voraciousness to want to work, and he's got this mm-hmm. thing of taking chances. Like from reading so much about him, there's only like one film in the last like 5 years that he's actually turned his back on. That was 2:11. He like said the way that film came out at the end is like, and not like that's not the film I signed on for. But I guess like an audience member for him as well, every set he's going on to, he's rolling the dice as well, right? And it's like either he's going to cash out at the end of the night big, or he's going to kind of go home empty-handed. And it's like,
well, regardless, he's going home with cash, because that's the thing with Nick Cage. He loves acting, and two, he loves money because he loves spending it. So that's why he does so much movies.
He loves stuff. Amazing. So what is your favorite Nick Cage movie?
So I mean, I take that as, because we have a separate question for best performance, so this is favorite movie with Nick Cage. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't want to pick the same movie for the same two questions, so I want to try and switch it up. You know, okay, I'm gonna go with Mandy. Mandy is, you know, a more recent one with Panos, and I mean, it's a movie that it's already just this visceral experience, you know, like this was, Cosmatos' second film. So, you know, he like his first film, Beyond Black Rainbow, is fucking insane and like, you know, crazy. So it's like, okay, we already knew what we were going to get with him. And then it's like, okay, then he adds Nick Cage into it. And again, he really pulled out Nick Cage's full range in the film. Like, you know, the first half dedicated to him being the stoic Nick Cage, and he's charming with his partner. And then we get the emotional Nick Cage whenever Mandy dies. And then we get, you know, balls to the wall. You know, we just mm-hmm. see him go up levels upon levels of, you know, cageness. And I mean, he literally just like put Nick Cage on full display. But then even aside from Nick Cage, just the movie itself is phenomenal. Like the score mm-hmm. by Johan Johansson is amazing. All the other performances, like the supporting performances matched up to it. And I love the fact that he wanted to play Jeremiah Sands initially.
No,
or no, oh no, was... Panos wanted him to Panos play Jeremiah, yeah, yeah. and then Nick said, "No, I want to play Red." And I thought that was very interesting, and you know, and because then it was like, okay, he's actually being challenged now, or he's giving himself more of a challenge, actually, you know. So Mandy is just, it's a phenomenal film. I can put it on any time of the day, doesn't matter when, like, and it is just so good. So my favorite movie would be Mandy, but Face Off is close. Yeah.
I totally understand what you mean about that movie, and I know it's not for everyone, and like I enjoyed it on a first watch, but then like on the second, it slightly did disappoint me because I think I wanted it to be more balls to the wall action, but then on a second watch when I watched it, I just let the film like wash over me, and in the way that I think it's intended to. And I'd read up a lot about Panos Cosmatos' thing, that he wanted it to be an outpouring of grief, whereas like Beyond the Black Rainbow is like suppressing grief.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted Mandy to be like a companion piece that was like the eruption of the anger and like malice you feel when losing something.
I mean, it's like flooded with like the reds and the pinks, like to do that, yeah. You know, literally. And when you say you gotta let it wash over you, like the very first time I saw it, whenever I got to see it in theaters, there's a famous theater out here in Los Angeles called the Vista, and it's like this gorgeous, you know, one screen theater, mm-hmm. and it's super nice. And then I ate a ton of edibles before going into this movie, a ton of edibles. I mean, like literally the first 10 minutes, I mean, I was like slumped and drooling. I had a smile on my face and drooling, and I was just like, oh yeah, this is for me. Like this is my shit.
Yeah. And I think it's the thing, like when I kind of like took, I don't know, I brought myself to the film because I let it like wash over me. But then it's that thing of like, for me, I looked at the like grief plot line as a thing of like just looking at loss. So even if it's like the loss of like a big relationship, which like you do go through that like weird grieving process after like a long term relationship, mm-hmm. or something like that. And it's like I like when those kind of like themes started to hit me, I was like, this film has like got a visceral gut punching feeling. And it's like, all like the thing that like Panos Cosmatos does really well, especially with Nick Cage, is whereas like a lot of filmmakers get like the Cage rage just for the sake of it, every piece of like Cage rage in Mandy is very much earned.
Yes, very much so. I didn't know if you glitched there for a sec. But yeah, no, very much so. And again, it's like when you know, people forget that, you know, Nick Cage has this like, you know, raw emotion, you know, that he's pulling from, and people always see it in the anger side, but then seeing it in a sad grief, you know, explosion is just like, I mean, that bathroom scene is like, yeah, it's him going, you know, yeah. doing his thing and going crazy. But at the same time, it's like, that is like such a realistic portrayal though of like, you know, somebody really trying to process grief. Like that, you know, is a little bit more realistic than when you see someone in a movie just like, you know, they're like kind of just like sobbing like to themselves and stuff. It's like, you know, if somebody had just a house to themselves and they just had that happen, like, yeah, they're gonna go crazy like that. And then it's like, that's what, you know, Nick Cage's extra flavor brings to the movie there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's really interesting because there's like a mess up, like the camera hits a towel that like Kate Cage had knocked over, and Panos Cosmatos said it was the best take, so we left that in, mm-hmm. because like that was he knew that they weren't gonna get like a better take from him, and he's like, it adds to the kind of like the drama of that situation. And it's like, yeah, it's messy. So if the camera all of a sudden on the dolly, or like the yeah, like just jolts slightly, it adds to that scene. And that scene, I think, is a fantastic kind of display of what Nick Cage can do.
Yes. I mean, it is. Oh, it's just so good. I love it so much.
So it's probably time we best talk about Kill Chain.
You have the eyes in the hands of a violent man. I know, because I know violent men. Does a violent man really think he's going to find peace?
If you need anything.
Here all night?
I was going to say dial 00. Yes, I am.
Thought you were the clerk.
Clerk, bartender, security guard, owner.
How long you had this place?
About a year. A friend of mine left it to me.
Well, we hear you don't have any friends.
Not anymore.
I'm getting out of a difficult situation.
Because you're using someone else's money.
I don't see it that way.
But someone does.
Do you know who I am?
You are a type.
Are you a type too?
Yeah. The kind that doesn't want to get shot.
You've got a bad feeling about this. Get out.
I leave without knowing what's going on, then I don't know what's going on.
He doesn't trust you.
I can trust you, but you can't trust me.
Right.
You want to die.
I kind of don't like you.
You set this in motion.
You want me to say I'm sorry? I'm not the guy you think I am.
You don't want to be, but you are.
I assumed you had a gun in your purse.
I did. I just got to the knife first.
You said earlier this was your first time watching the movie, right?
Yes, it was. I went in, like I said, completely blind. All I knew was Nick Cage, Assassin's Hotel. That's all I knew. And so I was excited to go into it. It was a more recent one. So I was like, okay, I hadn't really heard anybody talk about this one, and which shocks me.
So this is a really interesting one because it's directed by Ken Sanzel, who has kind of made his name a lot part from TV. So did like was a exec producer on Numbers and Blue Bloods, and doing a bit of like reading into Ken Sanzel, he used to be a policeman.
Oh, I didn't know he was a policeman. Interesting.
So, yeah, it's kind of got this world, and I think he started off doing. Like in film and TV being like a consultant on stuff regarding like cop stuff, like are they doing it right, and he's like kind of got this like interesting backstory, and then moved into stuff. And I think even as a policeman he was kind of like at a point where he was like doing a lot of like internal, like he kind of policed the police and stuff like that. So and looking on his Twitter, he seems like a pretty like politically woke guy, and like I think he's very like anti-police. Do you know what I mean? Like now he's very much like everything that's happened
in 2020. Yeah, he definitely had a lot to say in this movie, which is kind of crazy that you know it came out before 2020 was happening. So he definitely had a lot to say, and you can tell, and because this was only his second or third film, right? From what I saw on his IMDb, besides like his TV stuff, right?
Yeah. So as a feature director, this is his I think like fourth. I think it's his fourth movie, but like it's a lot of shorts and TV movies in there. But So what was your first like reaction to this movie? Did you enjoy it?
I very much enjoyed this movie. I had an absolute blast. I didn't know, like I said, like the kind of style even or tone that I was going for. So, but then definitely got the noir vibes off the bat from the opening. So I was like, okay, we're getting a neo-noir movie. And then like once it started happening, you know, because like it's a weird editing cut from the intro with Nick Cage, and then we get like a cut to the title sequence, and then it's like another weird cut. So I was like, okay, what's going on? And then once I kind of grasped what was going on, like, I like pseudo anthology movies. Like, I mean, this is a, you know, this is still a linear movie. It's just a circle, rather a chain, if you will. And I very much enjoyed, I enjoyed the style to it. And what was cool was, you know, it very much was committed to the neo-noirisms, you know, from the ever-present score to just the way that they talked and delivered dialogue that nobody says out loud in the way that they do, you know, like they, but they very much committed to it, which I always respect. But then it's also just like, I, so like whenever we like cut away from Nick, I was like, oh no, is this going to be like a movie where it's just like, he's just at the beginning and end and they didn't really get him for all that much time, but he comes back in, you know, halfway through the movie and then, you know, finishes out pretty strong. So I was like, okay, this is really cool. And it's like, we're getting the good, we get the good Nick Cage stuff in the back end. But it's like the first half, when we aren't spending any time with him and we're seeing the chain of events kind of get set off, I was still thoroughly entertained. Like, all the other actors were fantastic as well, and like had some unique action scenes in there. Like, I was very much here for this movie.
Yeah. So probably to go like a bit deeper into that kind of the way this is set up and it kind of, yeah. So we start off with this, like Cage, like the sequence of Cage, and you kind of are left a bit like, well, what the hell's going on? There's a guy slumped over a table, like presumed dead. We kind of see this, like this figure, like on the upstairs balcony, and we're like, well, who the hell's that? We got these two guys, like one rocking a disgusting mullet, like questioning Cage, and he's kind of like seems expectant of them turning up. And then we get like what I can only describe as like, it's a very like televisual title sequence, but really just like grabs you, right?
Yeah, they kind of, you know, they do the thing where they're just showing stills and shots that you're going to see throughout the movie, you know, so that way when you're watching, you can point at it. And but it's like kind of cool, though, because then it's like, OK, there's going to be, we see we're going to have a few different players here, you know, different characters are going to be coming in and out. And then it's like, OK, so, yeah, the tile sequence, like I said, it was just like kind of, it was edited in weird. But the tile sequence did grab me, though, because I was like, OK, I'm intrigued to like meet all these other characters.
Well, and I think for the budget of this as well. So this was a $3.5 million budget.
Ooh,
which like which is like in this day and age is not a lot, really, right? That's like,
that's
Blumhouse
too much
money.
At all.
Do you know, that's not even Blumhouse money. Like, they're normally like four's their kind of like their number, really, a lot of the time. And it's like for what this budget was and what you get, it's like, it's really, really fun and like inventive. And like, what one of the moments that really like stood out to me, and it seems very like a dumb thing to say, but like, there is a shootout like in a car, and like just like and I was like, I don't think I've ever seen that. Like,
that's exactly
in this
what I
way.
Said.
Like,
that's exactly what I said. I was like, I don't think I've ever seen a scene like this. I was like, a cop car shootout. They have a dead corpse flopping around in the background, you know, was so fun. And even the lead up to that scene was really cool. Like the whole bit, these dirty cops have an assassin in the back of the car, and like, you know, the assassin's getting in their head, these partners, and then they decide to turn on each other. So it was like, okay, I like the setup, but then like, the action scene itself was also like really fun. Like, they puts his feet down and he shoots the feet out, and I was like, haha, got his ass. But then it was the corpse. I was like, ah, they got me.
Well, it's the whole thing, the way, yeah, because the way it plays out. So obviously after the title sequence, we're just introduced to a totally new character who, even in the credits, like, nobody's really like, unless their name is said, you don't really like, you don't know who anyone is. And in the credits, this guy is just known as the old sniper. And we kind of like get him. He's scoping out a place. You don't really know what's going on. And it's like you're learning as he's learning kind of what's going on. There's a suspicious car. There's somebody on a rooftop. And he has this plan to get a sex worker to come up to his room and then like scope out the place for him so he doesn't get shot. And then, well, yeah, he like, sends her up to the adjacent roof and says, like,
it's like a little chess match.
And like, it's these nice little, like, and everything's like nice and contained. And that's what I mean. Like, for the budget, you get these like really, really inventive things. Cause it's like, I don't, for one, it's shot in Colombia as well.
Ah, like, that's where it was shot.
You get bigger tax breaks over there, or.
I thought it would be Puerto Rico because I know they, I know Puerto Rico has the tax break. So that's where I thought it was shot. I couldn't really tell though for sure. But that makes sense now. But yeah, I love me a good contained thriller.
Well, the only reason I could think it was potentially like shot there is Cage filmed Running with the Devil, also parts of that in Colombia. And I'm thinking like to match up his schedule, they were like, right, like, there's like, it's probably going to be quite cheap out in Colombia to film anyway. There might be, do you know what I mean? Like the cost of labor and stuff like that. And they're probably like, well, Cage is there. If we can like fit this, like, I'd imagine it like the shooting schedule of something like this, like maybe 3 weeks tops. Like you could piece a film like this together, right?
Yeah. Like they definitely like, you know, knew what they were doing with like the small budget, but then that's always, you know, we know in the industry that's usually better that if you do have the smaller budget, you know, the director tends to be able to do a little bit, have a little more freedom with what they're doing, you know, you know, as far as like the creativity aspect. So you know, I love that what they were able to do on this budget and also still very much like get the style and like tone down that that the director wanted.
One of the things that this film does really well is it gives you a lot of like character stuff, and like sometimes without actually like, I don't know, being too heavy on exposition stuff like that, it's like the phone calls that the assassin has at the beginning over the phone to his daughter, to his like handler, when he's just talking about like a rice cooker and stuff like that, we kind of get this thing that he's a guy who like has regrets and like desperately wants to get out of that life because he wants something as mundane as a rice cooker. And he has these like, we get these glimpses that he hasn't seen his daughter in 5 years and stuff like that. And you get this feeling, and like, yeah, when he like calls her back, it's like he knows that his number's up. Basically, he knows that Sanchez on the other roof is probably gonna get the best of him.
Yeah, like I really do like how each vignette, I'll say, you know, because they're not scenes, but like each set of scenes that we get for, you know, the different links of the chain. I do like that it does kind of, you know, we get the character stuff, then action, and then a little more character stuff, and then action. And yeah, you can kind of start predicting the, you know, the formula as the movie goes on. But then it does, like, you know, switch it up, though, as the movie goes, and that, like, you know, slows down even more with, like, an extended story sequence. So it's, like, I like that they very much did a nice balance of, like, you know, getting these character stuff in, but then also just, like, these, like, you know, interesting, you know, tense scenes, just because, like, you only know so much information, they only know so much information. And, yeah, those beats really do work out super well.
Well, it like plays onto the characters. So like, yeah, the film moves in the way that like it moves from character to character in a way that the demon from the Denzel Washington movie Fallen moves from victim to victim. It works in that. So like we get this thing of the old sniper, and then it moves over to Sanchez, right? And then we kind of get his story, and then he gets in the car with the cops. And then it's like, oh, it's their movie. And then it's like, it kind of has this disorientating but fun thing of like, oh, well, I don't know where this hot potato's, like who it's going to be thrown to next.
Yeah.
And it's like anyone who's on screen, you're like, oh, we're now with this person. And then it's like, I don't know. It second guesses you at every turn because it's like just as, and you're with them enough amount of time. Mm-hmm. That you're like, okay, like, I think I'm getting used to these characters. It's like,
nope,
see you later. They're gone.
Well, I noticed that the movie stresses pairs a lot throughout the film. You know, pairs and partners. They talk a lot about that. Like, everything is in twos in the movie. So it's like, yeah, you get two characters, and then it's like one goes, and then it's like, okay, now the next one goes on. So it's like almost kind of goes like a video game. It's like, okay, now you made it. You know, not only the characters aren't always going against each other. Sometimes they're together. Like once you see the dirty cop leave and meet up with the femme fatale, they're lovers. So then it's like, okay, they're not at odds against each other, but one of them's still going to die anyways, you know, and then ends up being the dirty cop, and then she moves on, you know? So it's like, they just like keep going throughout the rings. And then I was like, ah, the kill chain, I see it now. And then an interesting detail that I saw was that they also pass along a gun as it keeps going on. The gun starts with Sanchez, that silver gun. And then it kind of gets passed along throughout the situations as well, ending up, you know, at the end being, you know, the literal Chekhov's gun whenever, you know, the femme fatale gets saved by the assassin shooting himself, or not shooting himself, but it going off in his face. So it's like that gun is that also a literal kill chain. Badunce.
And there's this whole thing of like, you said about like the pairs thing. It's, yeah, you get it from like that thing is like, you get the two assassins almost like against each, like you get those two against each other, and like, you get those. And I think it plays into this whole thing that like Cage's story, like line in this is a thing of like him and his old partner, Franco, the guy who like used to own the hotel that he now runs. What did you make of Cage in this movie? Like, what did you think? Like when, cause like at near the tail end of this, it almost becomes like a bit of a chamber piece between him and the femme fatale, and then those two assassins, just kind of him telling this great story.
Yeah, like, so Cage in this, he definitely had a, like, subverted my expectations of, like, what I thought. Like, you know, the cover of the movie has him, like, holding the shotgun with his sunglasses on, so you think he's gonna be the main badass for the movie, and he is a badass, or a former badass, at least. And I like that we get, for a majority of the film, we have charming, stoic Nick Cage in this. We have Nicholas in this movie. And, you know, I'm glad that, you know, this director, you know, felt, you know, strong enough with, you know, the performances and, like, action beats that he was getting out of all these other actors that were, you know, chewing scenery just as much as Nick Cage likes to do, that he felt strongly enough about that to where he's like, okay, I can utilize Nick in a different way, because like people forget he has a very likable charm to him. Like he has like this kind of laid back everyman, you know, even though he is kind of larger than life, but he can also make himself feel like a relatable everyman as well. So it's like, I was like, okay, we're getting like a different side of him. And then I was waiting. So I was like, so is he gonna freak out? Like, you know, one of the questions you ask, I'm like, is he gonna freak out? And I mean, I don't know if you want to get to that yet, but like, you know, it just like kind of had me waiting, and then I just wasn't sure where he was gonna go with it. But I loved his performance in this.
Yeah, and like the way he's like introduced, so we get him introduced like up front, and then like it is that thing, you do get that fear that it's like it's gonna be like outcast, where it's like, oh, what? Yeah. Cage just bookends this movie. Like, oh, what?
Yeah, that's what I thought. And then, so I was very happy when he came back in at like the midpoint. And then we stick with him for, you know, the rest of the movie. I was like, okay, thank goodness he's in it more. We do get more Cage in here, because, like, even from that opening scene alone, like, you instantly are like, hey, I like this character already, you know? So I was very glad the way he was able to weave back in and, like, you see that, you know, he's surrounded in this world of violence and like all these other assassins, and he was that person, but you can tell he's changed, and he is like the one of them that is like, no, I actually am trying to literally put all this behind me, but he just kind of knows that's the world he lives in and like the way the things come to. But like the storytelling scene is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like that's something we don't get from Cage often anymore, you know, just like using him in the way that he delivers lines, which, oh my gosh, the line deliveries by Nick Cage in this movie. Whenever, side tangent, when the other femme fatale, like, chick comes looking for the other gal, and then she goes, "You know me?" And he goes, "Not specifically, but you're a type." I mean, me and my friend died. Like, that was so good.
Well, he has these fantastic little cages and like great little lines to deliver, and he's like, it's just after he delivers the line, I won this hotel in a poker game. It was a long game, but it turns out it's not worth that much. And then he takes a shot and then just goes like, what, with two like gun fingers. Yeah. And it's like, oh yeah, that's like, you can tell that was like a say, at least like Ken, let me have this shot. Like, let me have this take. I'll give you a little bit of cage. And it's like, perfect.
I mean, dare I say we get nuanced cageisms in this movie. Like, this is a very nuanced cage performance, because yeah, it's all about the little things. Like, because then he also follows up with a shot. They like show the close up and he like takes a shot and he just like has a contemplative look on his face and smiles, and then the camera cuts away.
Because yeah, like, so the femme fatale, the woman in red, as the credits call her, is looking for someone, and he's known as the spider, and you don't know who that character is, right? And then like Cage has that, like, there's that brilliant like interplay between them when like they're kind of like delivering lines about like the spiders and snakes, and he's like, well, you look like a woman who's like dealt with a lot of spiders and snakes in her time and stuff like that. And it is this, like, it's got the noir handbook and gone boom on the table. Like,
oh yes,
pick what you want from it. But like, I love that kind of stuff. And I think like this film to me had like an element of something like, is it Hotel Artemis? Like that kind of like, just on a very small budget, this kind of like hotel for ways and strays and like assassins and stuff like that. And it's like, I don't know, like it kind of wanted me to be like, why can't, like, why, like, please get Cage in like the John Wick series, like working in one of the one of the branches of the Continental or something like that. Do you know what I mean? It's this.
I don't know if us as humankinds, I don't know if we even deserve to have them too, both in a John Wick movie. I don't know if the world could handle it, but I would absolutely love that. But yeah, you definitely get those shades of it with this hotel, and you know, people vaguely know of each other, they know mutual people, you know, and have these like different backstory stuff that comes back into play, you know, later on whenever he's wrapping everything up with this story. And then you're like, oh yeah, I remember at the beginning that the old sniper said that him and Sanchez had history. Oh, had history, you burnt little girls to death, had history. So it's like, you know, the way that came back around, I was like, oh my gosh, like that's like really interesting. And so it's like all the character stuff was like definitely not for waste or anything. And then, you know, the interaction that he has with the lady in red's like, you know, again, like you, like I said, like I love that they stayed committed to the noir aesthetic to it. I'm like, they're gonna have a witty, bantery conversation, and of course, they're gonna fuck, and they fuck. But I love that they didn't even show the sex scene. She must have negotiated keeping her tits in, and good for her.
Well, yeah, but that perfectly comes back into play as well. And there's a great line.
And it does.
Later on, when they've like, so the I think her name's Gabrielle. She's kind of like the town hard bitch, like kind of quick, like boss bitch going about town. Like, she's got this guy Oso. He's downstairs with Cage, and we get this brilliant moment where like there's a fight upstairs, and like the henchman's like, oh, like he's all cocky. He's like bad mouthing off to Cage. And then we realize like, oh, his old tricks aren't that far behind him, because all of a sudden, like the henchman, like it looks like he almost like glitches out. He's like, cause he just keeps repeating the same line. And then you realize that Cage has poisoned him. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when he goes back upstairs and like yeah, and again we get that brutal like fight scene between the woman in red,
between
yeah,
the ladies.
Yeah, yeah, and it's like, Fuck.
With Nick Cage casually watching a cat fight going on the bed is my aesthetic. Like, he is watching a woman stab another woman just oh so casually. I love it. Like, I feel like he was supposed to be out of that shot, but he was already in, and they're just like, ah, fuck it. Just keep the scene going. It's okay.
But it, like, gives him chance to, like, have that great line where he's like, well, I thought you were going to go for the gun. She's like, well, yeah, I was, but I got to the knife quicker. And it's like,
but I got to the knife quicker. Oh, so good.
And it's that thing as well in this that, like, as much as, like, Cage's character, we're led to believe, is, like, maybe a little bit past it and, like, wants to settle down, he still does remember his old tricks, because he turns around to her and, like, says, like, you've got money. Like, I know you've got money because you've got it on your left tit, like, because you wouldn't let me touch it when we were fucking.
Yeah, the one who wouldn't let me touch. Like, the way he said it, like, again, it's like in the line deliveries. He's like, the one you wouldn't let me touch. Like as if he was, like, offended that while they were having sex, he could not touch that tit. And that, like, hurt him slightly, but then also ticked him off that, like, oh, she's hiding something there.
Well, the thing I'm thinking about now is, like, the sex scene was actually, like, the reason they wouldn't have filmed it is because a lot of it was, like, or at least showed us, is the fact that it was, like, him trying to grab her left tit and her just, like, slapping his hand away every time. He's, like, getting closer. He's like, nope.
And you just think it's like, oh, they're just, like, having playful, you know, like, kind of, you know, sparring around or whatever. You think it's just that, but then it's like, oh, like, that's a really fun detail to bring back into the fold. Like, all the details, like, mattered in this. Like, I love movies like that where it's like, you know, even if it's cheesy, like, when certain things come back into play, I still admire it for, like, committing to, like, trying to be clever and, like, trying to, you know, give you just, like, things to be like, oh, aha, okay, cool.
Well, he says to her as well, which I've written down as, like, one of the lines I loved, is, like, I'd love to go looking for it, but I don't think we have time right now.
Yeah, so casual. Again, just like, you know, he's cheeky, but, like, also it's just like, you know, like, yeah, Nick Cage is probably 25 years older than this gal, but would I buy that she'd fuck him? Yeah, because he's that charming.
Well, yeah, like, we like, back to your, like, Ghost Rider, he was 10 years older than Eva Mendes, and we were supposed to believe that they were the same age when they, like, grew up, all those, like, from those kids to the present day versions. We then, like, get, well, the film loops back around to the start, right? And you kind of get that moment where, like, you're either like, mm-hmm. I don't know, it either goes two ways for you. It's either an eye roll or you go like, ah, that's where that scene's from.
Oh, that, yeah, you're like, that's why that henchman is passed out now, like, because you're, like, wondering from the beginning of the movie, you're like that guy is obviously not drunk, like, what happened to him, you know? So it's like you're wondering from the beginning, which shout out to, like, again, like, how specific all the individual characters were. Like, this random henchman, he has his hair up in a ponytail, a Letterman jacket and braces on, but yet he's, like, insane. And I was like, all the characters are just, like, so very distinct, and I love that. But yeah, like, when it wraps back around and you're like, okay, now we're in it, we have some context, like, okay, obviously these are assassins just like the first two characters were, and we're gonna get just, like, all this interplay going. And that storytelling scene is really, really good. And that's like, you know, we almost get Cage Ray down. We almost get him, but then he pulls it back in, and, like, something about that is even more powerful. Like, you know, he almost unleashed it, and they just, like, crunched it back in. I was like, you know what? Like, you subverted me. You got me, Cage.
Well, it's got this perfect thing that it manages to use, like, different elements of Cage, and, like, he gets to tell essentially his life story of working for the organization. So, like, we get these, like, emotional beats within it, whether it's, like, him telling the story of Franco's daughter being, like, forced into, like, the drug mule life and being caught, and, like, her body being, like, dismembered out in a field and stuff like that. And as it delivers that line, it's like, she was cut into pieces. And he's like very like, do you know what I mean? Like gets these moments where like his eyes, but then like he brings it back down and he's like, and then like the next moment he's all quippy. And then like, cause it's all a ruse. It's all a ruse for him, but it's like, oh, fuck it. The guy can act. Come on.
I mean, he's got, the lady in red said it herself. She called him an onion earlier in the movie. And because Nick Cage has layers, I mean, he really does. Like you said, like the way he like bounced it from the sadness to the anger. And then he's like kind of sarcastically quipping as he like sloppily makes himself another drink. Like after like all night, he's been like carefully pouring everything, you know, like even that subtle difference was really interesting.
And then like it's revealed that he wasn't telling this story for their sake. He was letting the woman in red get into position. Like, because he tells them, right? He tells them, oh, I've got X amount of money in the safe. I've got all these diamonds. And like, they turn around and say to him, like, you know, that's not enough money to buy us off. Like, you used to work for this organization. He's like, well, I'm not talking to you. I'm talking to the person I've been talking to this whole time. And then like, shit fucking breaks loose.
And then, because I didn't catch it. But were they implying that the girl in red was also in that trade, or were all those girls like killed in the trade? Because I thought that would have been a fun detail to loop back in if that wasn't explicitly told.
I genuinely thought at one moment as he was telling a story before it was revealed that Franco's daughter was dead, that she was the woman in red. I thought like, because
maybe it was gonna be like a switcheroo thing.
Well, because in the story he mentions that like the daughter got involved with these two corrupt policemen called Erickson and Miguel, who are the two cops from earlier in the film. And then I thought like, oh shit, it's the woman in red. And then it kind of pulls the rug on that it's not her. No, I don't know. I think she's just another one. Like, she's like Franco's daughter. And I think that's why Cage, like, feels for her, is that, like, he probably, like, it's his way of redemption for what was done to Franco's daughter. Because she's, as much as it's not explicitly said, she's literally just come from being with Erickson and Miguel.
Yeah. It's still, I still love the way that everything tied back in. And I also love after he like tells the first portion of the story, another just like terrific line when the mullet mustache assassin calls him out like on the story being bullshit. And he goes, why the fuck would I make up a story like that? Like after telling a story about like, yeah, like girls in sex slavery and like getting burned, like, yeah, why would he make up that story? But just the way he says it is just, again, textbook Cage. And I love
it. Yeah, it's great little quips, doesn't it? Because like he says the story's going to be quick. And then like one of them interrupts and he's like, well, you're making this story go on a little longer if you wanted it to be a quick one. Like, yeah, he's just got this like great delivery. And then we get this shootout that like again is I think like totally believable, because it's people like you, and I guess this probably comes from like Ken Sanzel's background and knowing this stuff, is like you can have people in like shootouts be like a couple of like feet away from each other and miss, because like this is just people like shooting at each other from near on point blank range and just like constantly missing and kind of like running about this hotel in like a frenzy.
It's like very frantic. The you know police car shootout was similar, cuz it was like so compact, but yet they were still missing because one of them is trying to drive and the other guy is missing because he has a dead body, you know, in the back seat. So it's like, okay, that's believable in that police car shootout that they'd be missing each other and they're literally in the same vehicle. So yeah, it makes sense for the hotel. I will say, if he had been telling that story for so long, I mean, I will say Lady in Red, she should have gotten a better shot off.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like she had oodles and oodles of time. he shouldn't have even had to like tip her off, like saying like I'm talking, like she knew he was talking to him. So it's like he didn't even have to call her position out. She should have just been ready to pop, pop, pop. But again, then we wouldn't have had the shootout though. And the shootout is fun though. Like, you know, like obviously people that know what they're doing, they are come from similar backgrounds. They have similar tricks, you know, but they also don't know each other. Nick Cage knows the hotel better, so he has the home court advantage. So it's like it's a very plausible shootout. It's like there's not a lot of action scenes in this movie, but they make them count though.
Yeah. That's my thing. That's why I said in the intro, it's a lot of people talking about stuff, and then like we get these explosions of action. Like, but like that, like. Effect shot of when that hand cannon goes off, like explodes in that guy's hand, I had to rewind it. I was like, what have I fucking missed something? And then like what, like watched it like a couple of times, I was like, fuck, that's brutal.
It's gnarly. It's real gnarly. I love it.
Yeah, so the like what's the best way to explain it, right? The gun like almost explodes in half and just like embeds in his eye.
Yeah. Because I remember when Nick took it, and then he examined it when he took it from the goon, and then I guess at some point when he like examined it, I didn't see what he exactly did, because he did like open it up and he like did something, so I didn't see what he did, but he did like rig it up at some point again, like because like that's his methods of tricks, he just like kind of does it in other ways rather than having to always go like hand to hand or anything, you know, until he has to.
Yeah. Cause he blows away the black assassin, like with a shotgun, brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, obviously we get this, little like mustachioed mullet guy, like gets the hand cannon explode in his face. And then the film, like,
Another good Nick quip afterwards too. Whenever he sees the girl in red, and he goes, "In my day, a good professional always examines a weapon before they use it."
And then and then the film like again wraps round, because as they're like settling up and they're splitting the money, he gives her some of the diamonds. Cage goes into like one of the rooms in the hotel, and that's when you realize that it's the room of the sniper from the beginning. Even though I think,
yeah.
At what point did you clock on that assassin was in that hotel?
Oh, I knew he was in the hotel.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I just kind of figured. I was like, it is a big. I was like, it's a big place. He had his like, you know, silencers on, and Nick Cage is used to hearing gunshots. So like, I totally like get like that he was like in the hotel and like everything. And they did kind of lay out the geography pretty well throughout the film too, so mm-hmm. I caught on to that pretty early.
Well, I think it's like early on, because obviously you see the car that the sniper was looking upon was the car of those two guys, right? Like, so like that, uh-huh. That kept like moving around the block, and Cage has this interaction, and
There is a time too when Nick is with the lady in red, and then they hear gunshots start going off, and it's like that's when you know where the timeline actually falls back into place, because like you knew at the beginning of the movie that was like happening a little bit earlier, you know, the stuff with the sniper and then kind of catching back up to him, and there was like more gunshots, I think, or maybe I'm getting lost in the kill chain. I'm not sure.
No, because all the events would have had to have happened.
Oh yeah, before
she turned up, because
before Sanchez. Yeah.
She could. Yeah,
okay,
I thought
that does make sense.
I thought that she could have never have been there when.
Yeah.
I thought there was gonna be like a double switcheroo where it's like, oh no, that like, yeah, no, that couldn't have.
Yeah.
But then it could have set. Yeah, I thought it could have set it up so like. It was like a fake out in that, like, we thought that scene that we see right at the beginning was like, it could have got to that and then went somewhere else where, like, mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, yeah. But,
yeah, that's kind of where my brain was at.
But then you realize from confronting the old sniper that it was Cage's character that put the hit out on the old sniper. right? Like, cause he says to him, like, you had a chance to do something with those girls and never did it.
Oh, like I remember him calling him out with that line, but I didn't put it together that it was, oh. So he started the kill chain and he also ends the kill chain.
Yeah. Yeah, so obviously if it wasn't for him putting out that hit, that all this shit never would have been on. But then again, like, if he had never put out that hit, the woman in red would have never have come to his hotel and he never would have, like, escaped those two guys, like
also true,
coming for him. So, like, yeah, it's really, like, it wraps up quite neat. And, like, I've read some reviews of this movie online, and it's probably not as favorable as we've been to it.
I'm honestly confused. Like, I mean, okay, yeah, you might not love the cheesy dialogue, but it's like, again, that's them, like, committing to the noir. But I'm like, on a filmmaking, on a filmmaking, you know, scale, like, it's a competently shot film. I don't love all the handheld, but for the most part, it's shot pretty well. There is some good scenes, some interesting lighting. The sound design is good with, like, you know, from all the gunshots. There's even a shot where he shoots a shotgun through a sheet and you can hear the sizzle on the sheet. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, they got that going. The score is literally there the entire movie. And it's all really good. It, like, kind of switches tones too.
Yeah.
Between, like, the story and action beats. Like, so, like, on a, even just on a filmmaking aspect, it's hard to be like, okay, it's not a good film in that aspect. But then when you put the story and, you know, like I said, I liked all the performances, like, on a varying scale from like to really love, you know, besides for Miguel the cop, he was kind of he was kind of bringing some bitch game, but everyone else brought it, you know, for what their characters are. So, like, I don't know if, you know, I saw, you know, people throw around the world, like, indulgent, and I hate that because, like, that's what you're supposed to do as a director. Like, if you like neo-noir movies and you want to make a badass neo-noir movie where you link everything together and try to make it clever because that's, like, something you're passionate about and you want to do it, damn right indulge yourself in it. So I don't know, I just don't get it. I can get this not being the movie for you, but I don't get saying that this is a bad film.
Well, I think it's that thing, I tend to go in, especially if I look at a budget of a movie, and go, like, what have they managed to do on that budget? And it's like, this tells a fun, competent and decent story on, like, on a small budget. And it's like, What more do you want for, like, a $3.5 million movie? And it's like, yes, they probably knew this film's, like, lifespan was going to be on VOD. It was going to be on Amazon Prime. Do you know what I mean? Like for, in the UK, it's on Amazon Prime. I think in the US, it might be as well. I think it's, like, kind of, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, I watched it. Yeah, I watched on Amazon Prime as well. And it's like, it does the job of, like, if you're going to be scrolling through a streaming service and randomly throw something on and have it entertain you, yeah, like, this movie is going to do that for you and more, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's a totally, like, it's a film that's better than it has any rights to be, like, in the fact that it is a Nick Cage straight to VOD movie. And is just, I don't know, a good slice of neo-noir, like, fun that, like, again, like, I hate that thing of, like, I hate the idea of, like, guilty pleasures and stuff like that, because you either like something or you don't. And, like, I know there's frequent listeners and previous guests on this that always give me a hard time for kind of,
I mean,
being overly complimentary to films that, like, on a grander scale probably aren't, like, masterpieces, but that could be the fact that I'm, like, over 100 episodes deep into a Nick Cage podcast.
I mean, yeah, but this is still different than, like, the true B-movie Nick Cage fare that you have, that you do enjoy in a more guilty fashion, but I still wouldn't call them guilty pleasures. I don't believe in them either. But this movie itself, like I said, it's like, this wasn't a movie that needed to be like saved by Nick Cage. It's fun. Is it a masterpiece? No, but like, you don't always need to like go into a movie wanting a masterpiece. Sometimes you want to just go into something and be entertained and have fun. And like, I watched this with a friend last night in preparation, and this is a movie I will 100% like show to like other friends. It's like, this is a fun movie night. Watch with your friends, like have a good time movie. But it's also like on a, you know, film on a film level, pretty well made.
Yeah.
For, like you said, the budget at least.
And Cage has got a brilliant sparring partner in Annabelle Acosta, who plays the woman in red. Like, I think like that that, mm-hmm. that casting of those two, it's like you might like people might have problems with the whole like there's an inevitable sex scene or whatever, or like they might get hung up on all that, like, oh, but Cage is like, Cage is this old.
But their
dude.
Chemistry.
Yeah, the chemistry is great.
The chemistry works. The chemistry works. I mean, you know, I would be so lucky to have a sex scene with Helen Mirren in a film. Who cares about the age difference? I don't care. But their chemistry was really well together. Like at first, like when she was introduced with the dirty cop, I was like, okay, don't really love the like, okay, we're going to take a little romance Bonnie and Clyde detour. Luckily, that scene didn't last long with them two, and she moved on pretty quickly, luckily. And then once she got to the hotel and she was with Nick Cage, like, yeah, their connection and, like, chemistry together was just, like, really perfect. Banter back and forth, like, she matched his levels of, you know, quippiness. Like, it worked really well.
Well, there's that fantastic scene, I think, like, kind of almost midway through the film where she literally transforms into a femme fatale when she's in the back of that truck and is getting like dressed and like comes yes. out in the high heels and the red dress. And it's like,
yeah, I totally forgot about that scene. And that's also a really good scene. Like she's like talking this guy through the mugging, you know, and like making it, you know, it's like, hey, this is as good of a carjacking as I'm gonna get. If this is how I have to get carjacked and lose my job, you know, at least I got, you know, to hear some sweet whispers nothing in my ear, and she paid me and it was all good. It was a really interesting little scene, because it's like he almost, you can almost tell that like in this area stuff like that happening mm-hmm. isn't uncommon, because he's not like terrified or like, you know, like surprised. It's kind of like, ah shit, well, it's just one of those nights, you know.
Hey, he's got a woman like dressing in the back of his car. He definitely got a few glimpses in that rearview mirror. It was a couple of glances at what was going on in the back, I reckon. So he was probably like, I got some money, I got a little bit of side boob action, I'm all happy.
Again, there's worse yeah. ways to get mugged. Way worse.
Perfect. So let's move on to the questions I always ask on these at the end. A weird scoring system. Does Nick Cage have bad hair in this movie?
I say no. He is tightly well-groomed in this movie. Mm-hmm. His beard is perfectly well-kept. The hair looks good. It's nice and full, but it's not in a funky shape. Like, I say his hair is pretty good in this.
It's a solid haircut, and like the beard's looking perfect. And I think like that's mm-hmm. his kind of look now. There's a fantastic cover shot he did for Interview Magazine. And there's like these kind of like this photo shoot he did for Interview Magazine. And with the trailer drop in for the new Netflix show he's doing, he's looking great.
He looks fantastic in that Netflix trailer. I was like, oh damn. Like when he said naughtiness, I was like, ooh, don't you dare, Nick Cage. He's looking good. Yeah.
Amazing. And then on to the second question is, does Nick Cage do a crazy voice? Obviously, we talked about Vampire's Kiss earlier. I think possibly his most famous crazy voice. But does he do anything like that in this?
Yeah, so that is one thing that I do love about Nick Cage. Like, I remember like in an interview how he like mentioned, like, you know, that's one of his favorite parts about crafting his character is coming up with the voice and accent he's going to do for him, because he tries to make every single one of them different. He attempts to. But does he do a crazy one here? No, it's pretty straightforward. Like, he doesn't put like, he has a slight twang on his voice, but like, he's not like, he keeps it at like a consistent level for most of the film too. Like, not doing anything too crazy vocally, really.
But he has these like brilliant things that, as we said, like there's enough little like cageisms in the way he delivers certain lines that it's like
we get a few flares here and there.
Yeah,
like in the delivery, but as far as like the actual voice goes, like it's pretty. Yeah.
It's
normal.
Like that scene from Hook when the little kid's like pulling back Robin Williams' face, like when he delivers those lines, like, ah, oh, there you are, Nick. Like, there you are. There's the Nick I remember. And what a lot of like, I'm going to call them idiots, go to Nicolas Cage movies for a lot of the time is freakouts. The true fans know that he has got range and scope and can do so much more, but does he freak out in this movie?
You know, so we kind of danced around a little bit, but I wouldn't, you know, does, because you know I am a true Cage head, I believe. And is this a full rage Cage moment, you know, that storytelling scene? I will say no, because like we described the scene, like, I mean, he's getting there. He has tears in his eyes. He's like red and shaking, and you can see it. And then he just brings it back in. He shoves it down deep. And I was like, wow, like it was a reverse Cage freak out kind of. I don't know, but did he freak out? Almost, but. In my notes I wrote controlled Cage rage is what I called it.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's future stomach ulcer Cage rage where you're like burying it deep down, and it's the thing. I think like that's better than getting a full freak out because it shows some restraint both from Cage and both from the director as well, because it's like I don't think this film warranted any like balls to the wall freaking out, really, like that isn't who that character is, I don't think.
I like that you mentioned that it's restrained on both their ends, because it's a moment that Cage could have went bigger, but he really got to do something a little bit different, subvert us a little bit, and you know, really flex his acting chops a little bit. But then restrained on the director, because like you said, like earlier in the show, there's some, you know, directors that, you know, are kind of just in awe of Cage, and they're like, well, I have him, so I just gotta let him let loose, you know. So other directors might have just been like, yeah, Nick, go crazy. But obviously, you know, the director here, Sanzel, was like, you know what? No, we're gonna keep it in. We're gonna keep it tight, and you know, and I think that's gonna be more effective. So yeah, good call on both their ends.
Perfect. So thanks so much, Devon, for coming and raging with Cage with me. Where can people keep up to date with everything you're doing, whether it's writing or with your podcast?
Yeah, thank you so much for letting me on. This was absolutely so much fun. You guys can find me on Twitter and Instagram at _daddydisco. And Instagram is where I have most of my photography and like more videos and short filming kind of stuff. And then Twitter is, you know, more movie type deals. That's where I post the stuff that I write for Nightmare on Film Street. I have a monthly column on there called Stoner's Corner, because I am a big time pothead and I try to find trippy movies, and I provide weed recommendations in those articles as well. So I do that. And then I'm also the content manager for Beta Wave TV. It's a media production company, and we do like live stream music concerts and music videos and stuff. So you can find us there at betawave.tv. And then, of course, I host the Bloody Blunt Cinema Club, a podcast where I have all different guests on, and we talk subgenres. Sometimes it's one movie, sometimes it's three. You never know. You can find me at Bloody Blunt CC on Twitter for that.
Perfect. Again, thank you so much for coming and talking about Kill Chain with me.
Yeah, thanks once again. I had a blast.
Thank you once again to Devon Taylor for joining me to talk about this fantastic film. If you enjoyed this film, or you kind of want a little bit more knowledge on the process that Cage goes to make a film, be sure to listen this Friday. Yes, this coming Friday, to a bonus episode where I sat down and talked to the writer-director of this film, Ken Sanzel. I recorded it this Monday, so the 11th of January. It's a fantastic conversation. As I said, we kind of get into like Cage's process, the influences on this film, like what was the watch list, the kind of the moral ambiguity in characters that makes them so much more three-dimensional than this kind of black and white good and bad guys, and how kind of Ken went from being a cop to going into the movie business. And it's a great story, so do be sure to tune in to that one. As always, if you feel differently about this, so if you didn't enjoy it as much as I do, I know there's people out there who are like, Petros, you've lost your goddamn fucking mind. And yes, Liam Dempsey, I am talking to you specifically. But there's other people who are probably like, I don't like these films. I don't understand what you're seeing them. I'm not a corporate shill. I genuinely only contacted Ken as well after I'd seen this film and enjoyed it. I wouldn't have like agreed to do an interview and kind of praised his film. Yeah. If that's what you're thinking, that's definitely not the case, guys. Although, if the money is right, I will definitely talk good about a film if you pay me loads of money. Come on. But yeah, if you feel differently about this, please do not hesitate to get in touch, which is Caged In Pod on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And support the podcast. You can do that really simply by heading on over to Apple Podcasts, Acast, wherever, rating, reviewing the show. All of those kind of 5-star ratings and those glowing reviews really do help the numbers to get more people ears on the podcast, basically. It kind of gets out there, moves up the charts and stuff like that. People kind of might see the art and go, oh, I'll give that a go, see what that is. Or you can, as I said in the intro, you can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod. You can head on over to Ko-fi, which is ko-fi.com/cagedinpod, and just do like a one-off donation to the podcast if that's what you want to do. Literally £3. I'm in the process at the moment of buying all of the Coppola family films, and I can get myself The Beguiled on Blu-ray for £2. So if you just want to do a one-off payment and get, like, essentially buy The Beguiled for me, that will be fantastic. And otherwise, you can support, obviously, there's limitedrun.com. So it's cagedinpodcast.limitedrun.com, where you can pick up the Tim Hornsby Caged In Superman print. And coming up very soon, I'm super excited about this. I've never been, this is like genuinely a bucket list moment for me. We're releasing the first ever Caged In t-shirt, so if you're not following on the socials, do be sure to check out the design. I'll pop a link in the show notes as well, where you can kind of see the design in its full glory. But yeah, it's this kind of Wicker Man Nicolas Cage hybrid, kind of the old Wicker Man, the new Wicker Man, and it's fucking great. And that's designed by a guy called Tim Sinclair. So the illustrators are the only illustrators I fuck with are Tims. I'm a Tim fucker. That's all I deal with when it comes to illustrations. But yeah, do keep an eye out and an ear out for when that is dropping, because as soon as it does, I'll be shouting about all over the place. I think it's going to be up for pre-order. So obviously, they're all hand-printed by a friend of mine, Harry, over at Ham Prints. You can find those guys on Instagram. So they're all going to be like screen-printed by hand, by Harry. And we're kind of like, it's going to all be dependent on how many are pre-ordered. So that would be amazing. I'm trying to keep them as low cost as I can. Obviously, I'm factoring in Harry's time, the cost of printing, the cost of the t-shirts. But they will be at a genuinely reasonable price. And all money will go back into the podcast and potentially back into getting more cool merch and other stuff for you guys. So one last piece of admin before I let you go is next week's full episode, and that is with the fantastic musician, podcaster, and just all round nice bloke Mike West, where we talk about the 2019 kind of action drama It is essentially Snakes on a Plane on a Boat with a Tiger and Nicolas Cage film Primal. So do tune in to listen to that one, because it's heaps and tons and all the fun buttered on toast. As always, guys, I've been Petros Patsilivas. I've been caged in. You've been amazing. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.